Hello, this is Gidon Rothstein, and this is a response of a day for the 13th of Nisan. Pesach is coming, and so the issues that we're going to talk about today are a little bit about Pesach issues. It is probably a last opportunity for me to mention the book I have about Pesach called As If We Were There, Readings for a Transformative Passover Experience. While you've already missed the opportunity to read them on the time in the timeline that I gave for them in the book, you do have the opportunity, if you run out and get it, or if you can get it from Amazon by tomorrow, to have it for the Chag and have it accompany you on the Chag, which I think and I hope will be productive for you. If it is or isn't, you can email me at grothst@gmail.com. Let me also thank Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, David Hochhauer, and the OU.org staff and people for the opportunity to share these shiurim with you. For today, we're going to see a response of the Avnei Nezer, which is, I think, also a new commentator, a new Meshi for us. The Avnei Nezer, I've looked a couple of times to be able to share things with you of the Avnei Nezer. The Avnei Nezer was a Hasidic Rebbe who was known for his Torah knowledge, Rav Avram Bornstein. He was the Av Beis Din of Sukkotchev. So I think he's known as the Sukkotchev Rebbe, and was a student of his father-in-law's, Rav Menachem Mendel of Kotzk, who was the Kotzk Rebbe. In any case, so he's a Hasidic guy who's a tremendous Talmud Chacham and is known in both capacities. So this is from Chelek Or HaChaim, the Or HaChaim section, Siman Shin Nun Tet, response number 359. It's dated the 13th of Nisan of Tov Reish Nun Dalet, 1894. And he says, despite the fact that time is precious, it's the 13th of Nisan, right? So it's the day before Erev Pesach. He took a little bit of time to answer you in great brevity. So in great brevity, I, again, as always, hack down these tshuvot to cut them to their bare minimum and sometimes probably do them injustice to my chagrin, but it's the best I know how to do. So when he says b'kitzur, the definition of that word in brevity is always an interesting one. The question was, when it comes to chametz after noon on the 14th, do we say tam ki ikar min haTorah? This is a question that gets into lots and lots of basic kashas issues. I think that's part of what stood out for me when I was looking at it, because we don't know if we always have an opportunity in these contexts to review basic kashas issues. So there are things that are kosher and there are foods that are not kosher. So if we just avoided foods that were not kosher, that would be one level of kashrut. In fact, halacha has assumed, and this is a debate, we'll get into a little bit of it here, but it's a debate that has been decided in favor of assuming that ta'am ki ikar, that even if you have just the taste of something, even if, and we'll see a few examples of how you could have just the taste later on in the tshuva, but let's say you have just the taste, however it happens. You know, I grind something up in it, or it dissolves completely, one food dissolves completely within another food, and therefore there's no actual part of the food anymore, but it does leave a taste. Does that count as the original prohibited item, min haTorah? Is it a Torah prohibition against tam ki ikar? So we, for whatever reason, generally assume that yes, it is. The question here had to do with chametz afternoon on Pesach. So for this, we have to remember that chametz during most of the year, leavened bread, foods that are leavened, right? Breads, bagels, all those things are during most of the year just fine, perfectly acceptable to eat. Come Pesach itself, if one eats it on purpose and knowingly, whatever, one would incur a karet punishment. They are a karet prohibition. On the afternoon of the 14th, it's slightly different because that's the time when we would have offered the Korban Pesach. If we had a Beit HaMikdash, we would have offered the Pesach sacrifice if the temple were standing. And there's a special prohibition, as it happens, of not offering the Pesach sacrifice when there is when one owns chametz. And also, there is the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda in the Gemara that owning chametz, or that it's already the prohibition, becomes a full Torah prohibition. It's not a Kari prohibition, but there's a Torah prohibition against owning chametz and eating chametz from the 14th at noon. So if it's a Torah prohibition, then you would assume that we would say tam ki ikar min haTorah. But the man who's writing to the Avnei Nezer with this question noted the note of Yehuda, who in the second volume of his Tshuvot in Or HaChaim 66 seems to have held otherwise, for reasons we're about to get to. So the Avnei Nezer says, I looked at the note of Yehuda, and he wrote his halacha about chalav tameh, non-kosher milk, or eggs that we're not allowed to eat. And see, he said you can't get those from the pasuk about Nazir. Sorry, another piece of background. The way the Gemara derives the idea that tam ki ikar is min haTorah, the taste itself alone is prohibited, is from a pasuk regarding a Nazir. A Nazir is a person, a man or a woman, who decides to accept upon themselves certain restrictions. They think it's going to create greater sanctity in them, whatever reason they do it for. And among those restrictions are anything that has to do with grapes. It's not just wine. Everybody talks about wine, but it's not just wine. It's wine, grapes, and the pasuk refers to mishrat anavim, a solution of grapes. Like you soak grapes in something, and then you take the grapes out. There's no grapes there. There's no actual grapes, but there's clearly the taste of the grapes, and that's called tam ki'ikar. So the Noda Behuda apparently claimed, I didn't look up the Noda Behuda myself, we're learning the Avnei right now, the Noda Behuda apparently claimed that source, it doesn't work for the case of beitzim, of non-kosher eggs or non-kosher milk, because a nazir would get malkot, would get lashes for willfully violating the prohibitions that apply to him or her, whereas chalav and beitzim are ordinary prohibitions that don't have malkot for the reasons of the derivations of how those came along. So that's what the Rebbe just says. These are just a plain prohibition that doesn't have malkot to it, doesn't have lashes, even if somebody transgresses it on purpose and willfully and deliberately with warning. And therefore, the Nodi Yehuda seems to think that the whole idea of tam ki ikar, of counting the taste like the original item is there, is a stringency. So what he seems to be saying is, so if I know that stringency applies to a nazir, to the prohibitions of a person who's taken upon this status as a nazir, that doesn't mean that it would apply to lower level prohibitions, and milk and eggs are lower level prohibitions. They're just a plain isur. So whether that would apply to an isur assay, the Avdin Ezer says, we'll get to. Right, whether his logic would extend, meaning the person asking the question said, well, if that's true of milk and that of non-kosher milk, it's true of non-kosher eggs, which are a plain prohibition, a plain isur, not an isur that incurs lashes, that it should be true for chametz after the noon on the 14th, because there the prohibition also is what's called an isur asay. An isur asay is where the Torah tells us to do something. I think here it tells you to tashbit, it tells us to get rid of the chametz. By virtue of the Torah telling us we have to get rid of the chametz, we know we can't have it and eat it and things like that. So therefore it becomes prohibited. So would the Noda Behuda, the question would be, would the Noda Behuda assume that therefore it also doesn't have the standard of tam ki ikar? Of that we would count the taste as if the original item was there. So that's the basic question. But before you can answer that question, the Avnei Ezer says, I don't understand or I don't know that the Noda Behuda's reasoning is quite so clear. I think it's unclear, because the Noda Behuda thought that his idea, that the idea of tam ki ikar is restricted to certain levels of prohibitions, and that lower levels of prohibitions, in fact, the taste doesn't count as if the original item is there, and it's only prohibitions that have lashes, so that's an odd idea. But the Noda Behuda didn't think it was an odd idea. He thought it was a good idea, and not only did he think it was a good idea, he thought it explained also an idea in the Shach. The idea in the Shach had said, there's another halakhic question in terms of kashrus issues that comes up. When you ship certain kosher items with non-Jews, how do we guarantee, or how do we feel comfortable that non-Jews didn't substitute it? The worry seems to have been, and today there could be other ways about thinking about this, but the worry seems to have been that a non-Jew would be tempted to take whatever it is, it could be wine, it could be food, it could be meat, it could be milk, whatever it is, to take it and then substitute some of his. That either could be because ours is more expensive and better, or it could also just be because ours is available at a time when he's hungry, thirsty, in need, and he figures, and I'll substitute later. So it's not that we're ascribing to these non-Jews any nefarious motives. They're just thinking, I might as well substitute it, because what's the big deal, and I need this now. For us, it's of course a problem, because if they substitute non-kosher, then we have non-kosher food instead of kosher food. But they don't know that. They don't realize that. They don't know what they're doing. So the halakhic requirement is to seal up our kosher foods in such a way that we make it so difficult for them that we assume they won't bother going to that trouble to get to our kosher food, right? Because it's not meaning. If they had a thing in their heads, it was a part of their evil plan, and it was very vital and important to them that they do this, then, you know, they do anything they can get to get around, or they do a lot of things. But that's not really what we're worried about. We're just worried about that they will casually be interested in our food, planning to replace it, and therefore we want to have some kind of a system in place. So often the system is what's called a chotam b'tor chotam. You have two seals, one on top of the other. You have that, for example, when you have bottles of wine. So the truth is, even mevushal bottles of wine, even bottles of wine that have been heated such that we no longer believe that they can make that there's a problem with stam yenem, with wine that has been touched by a non-Jew, even those you often sell with a double seal. But certainly bottles of wine that have not been treated in that way, and therefore that theoretically if a non-Jew were to touch it or have access to it, would become a problem for our kashrus issues, you will double seal those. That's a chotam b'tor chotam. The Shach held that when it came to milk, it was good enough to have one chotam, one seal. Now, what's odd about that is that one seal is generally assumed to be sort of breakable, to be easily circumvented. The non-Jew might one day want some milk, say, I'll just substitute my milk when I'm done or when I get around to it, right? Let you know, if he's got three stops on his, if it's a shipping situation, and he's going to ship it to New York, but along the way he's going to stop in Chicago and in Pittsburgh, and he's on the train to Chicago, the non-Jew says, you know, I'm really thirsty, I'm going to have some milk, and in Chicago I'll buy some milk and I'll refill it. So how do you avoid that? So the Shach seems to have felt that one seal would be good enough. And the reason the Shach gives is because if most of the milk came from a non-kosher animal, then it would certainly be noticeable. Okay, so that's a claim. That's a whole practical claim, right? Milk from non-kosher animals looks different, feels different, tastes different than milk from kosher animals, and therefore if it was majority non-kosher milk, we would know about it. And what if it was minority non-kosher milk? Let's say he had, you know, I'm sipping a vat of, I don't know, 20 liters of milk, and I don't know if 20 liters makes a vat, but let's say 20 liters of milk, and he only had 5 liters of milk, and he replaces the 5 liters. So that too could be a problem because, well, for one thing, you think about Tom Kikar, right? It'll taste of the non-kosher milk. So the Shach says, "Ubiut min haTorah batel birov." That minority stuff, from Torah perspective, is batel birov, is nullified. It's swallowed up by the majority at a Torah level, and therefore the Shach thinks that if I put one seal, so I'm trying to prevent it, that fulfills the rabbinic need to avoid the non-Jew mixing in some of the milk and then having it become batel. But the problem is that people pointed out or claimed is that they assume that non-kosher milk tastes different than kosher milk. If non-kosher milk tastes different, and we hold ta'am ki ikar, and we hold that the taste is a Torah problem, as most authorities do in other situations, then the fact that it's a minority won't make it batel because it's ta'am, its taste will be there. So then Rabbi Yehuda says, aha, you see, when it comes to milk that's non-kosher, we don't say ta'am ki ikar. That was a support. He quotes it as a support for his idea. It's approved because that must have been what the Shach was thinking. Otherwise, the Shach has a big problem. How could he have one seal for a problem that could be a Torah problem? We're not going to get to that answer to that question because our topic is the Nebi Yudin Tam, not the Shach. But besides the Shach, the Shach doesn't really write that, says the Avnei Mezer. The Shach actually writes, he doesn't write just that minorities are batel birov. He says, min bemino batel birov, that when two items that are the same type of item are mixed together, the minority, it's batel birov, is nullified by the majority. But according to the Noda Behuda, the issue isn't that it's min bimino, not min bimino, because the whole question of ta'am, of taste, actually comes up when it's not, when it has a distinct taste. So min bimino is a halakhic concept about, what if I have two items mixed together that are exactly the same, except that one is non-kosher? So for example, if I have cow meat, two sets of cow meat, one which is shechted by in a kosher way, one of which turned out not to be shechted in a kosher way. We have everything that tastes exactly the same on a Torah level. Nonetheless, we would say min bimino is batel. Those are solids. When it comes to liquid too, the same thing. Let's say I have a bunch of Pinot Noir. It's all the taste fundamentally the same. It's all the same bottles of Pinot Noir. I have 10 bottles of Pinot Noir, and let's say I don't have them be mevushel, and then two of them get touched, you know, get poured out by a non-Jew, and therefore our problem of stam yenam. So they're exactly the same bottles, they have the exact same taste. So that's where min bimino comes into play. So the Avnei Mezer is saying, so I don't know, Rabbi Yehuda, why are you assuming the Shach is talking about the Tam issue? He seems to be talking about the Min Bimino issue. Min Bimino, that they're the same Min, just that you're swallowing it up. That's a whole different discussion because that's not a question or an issue of Tam. It's also a problem because it ignores another problem with the Shach, which is that when the Shach says the Chalav Tameh is the miut that's been mixed with the rove, right? It's the minority aspect of this mixture that's mixed with the majority aspect of this mixture, but it is a kizayit b'chdei achilat pras. This is another issue in halacha, another fundamental topic in kashrus, and that's again part of why I thought we really want to remember this, right? So far we've had the idea you can have mixtures in which one thing is a majority, one thing is a minority, and one standard will be majority rules, and that's true at a Torah level in many instances. So if you have a majority on a Torah level, majority rules, and the minority is batel birov, is swallowed up or nullified or obscured by the majority, that's number one possibility. At the other extreme, you have the question of ta'am, which is what most of our kashrus today focuses on. We're worried about if things get mixed in, And there we say that if it's in, usually we say that it's within the proportions of 1 to 60, we worry a bit that there might be the ta'am, the taste there of the non-kosher item, and therefore we'll say that's a kosher problem as well. So that, but then that will be a question of, is it a Torah level kosher problem? That's the question we're dealing here with. This chametz on the afternoon of the 14th of Nisan, is it a Torah level problem or is it a Rabbanon level problem? That's our overall general question. In between those two standards, there's an issue of what's called a kizayit b'chdei achilat pras. Let's suppose I have a mixture, and it's usually about a sixth or an eighth, depending on, there's a debate about what a kizayit is, what a pras is, but usually about one. So I always get these numbers mixed up, but I just checked now. The Rambam says a kizayit b'chdei pras is to eat a kizayit to take in the time it would ordinarily take an ordinary person to eat three kibbetzim. And I think a kibbetz is two zeitim. It's generally said to be two olives worth. So that would be eating the kizayit in a time that really would take it six, within the time it would take an ordinary person to eat six of those. And I think Rashi thinks it's four beitzim, which it would be eight of those. I think that's the issue. And anyway, the point is, so if 1/6 or 1/8 of the mixture was the prohibited items, it's true, it's the minority. So it's the minority, you might have said it's batel b'rov, but there's a problem there, because once the gezayit b'chdei achilat pras, there's that much of the original problematic prohibited items there, then not only is there a tamka ikar issue, right, there's a taste issue, but also, even according to Rashi and the Rambam, who are the ones who hold the tamka ikar is not a Torah proposition, the tamka ikar was a rabbinic proposition, but they themselves hold that this was called ta'amo u'mamasho. There's a Gemara that talks about the different ways that we can ignore, when we're allowed to ignore Yisrim that have gotten mixed in and we can't get them out. So there's a difference between where there's ta'amo ve'ein mamasho, there's just the taste, but none of the actual substance of the item. And then the Gemara talks about something that's called ta'amo u'mamasho. So it's clearly not the majority, but it's the taste. And there's the actual item there. So for Rashi and Avodah Zorah, Samach Zayin Amid Bet, Ta'amo v'lo mamasho, when we say that there's the taste only, it means that the item has dissolved, right? It has been ground up, and it's not there at all. But this is not that way. When it comes to non-kosher milk, you'd have to say it's Ta'amo v'lo mamasho, because Rashi seems to think that before we can say that it's just taste, it has to mean the original item isn't there in any meaningful way. It's been gotten rid of. But in the case of non-kosher milk, it hasn't been gotten rid of. It's just mixed in. But that's always true of a mixture. So that wouldn't count as ta'amo v'lo mamasho. Meaning for Rashi, the Ebenezer is saying, for Rashi, the milk mixing in at a proportion up to 1/6 or 1/8, that would be not fundamentally different than, let's say, I had a stew of meat and I got a bunch of pieces of meat mixed in together and I have enough meat that it's ta'amo, it's like, because there's enough meat. So it's the original thing is sort of still there. And the Rambam holds that anytime you have a kizayit b'chdei pras, this is the Rambam's opinion in lots of issues, in chametz issues, in lots of issues, that anytime you have a kizayit b'chdei pras, that's not called ta'amo. So let's say, I think an example is, let's say I make a souffle and I mix up a bunch of things in it and the non-kosher stuff is mixed throughout in a proportion of about 1/6. So that, I might have thought, well, it's not there anymore. It's a whole new item. You can't see it. You can't identify it. I might have thought that's just the taste showing up. But the Rambam says, since I know that in that item, in that mixture, this item is there within 1/6, that's called ta'amo mamasho. And therefore, the point is, you don't need ta'am kikar. You don't need to say this idea that we treat taste as if the original item is there, because that might be a drab on a proposition. Or, according to this Nona Behuda, even if it's a deraita proposition, the Nona Behuda was claiming it's a deraita proposition, it's a biblical proposition only for certain prohibitions, which don't include non-kosher milk and don't include, this is our more important one, chametz on the afternoon of the 14th of Nisan. But says another answer, I don't know why you're getting into that, because if you have enough of it, it's not an issue of just ta'am, it's ta'am o'ma masho, at least according to Rashi and the Ramba. Thanks to the Avnezer, that's what the truth is. That's all poskim, except for Rabbeinu Chananel, who held that you can only have ta'amo u'mamasho, you can have the actual item if you can recognize it. Rabbeinu Chananel was the only one who said, if you no longer can recognize it, if it's gone. But the Avnezer is saying, but the other Rishonim, especially certainly Rashi and the Rambam, all held that if you can, if it's there in significant enough proportions, then it's still like it's there. So some might have said that doesn't apply to our shach situation because the shach says it can't get mixed in so well. But the Rav Nezer says the shach doesn't say that non-kosher milk doesn't get mixed in so well. The Rav Nezer said once you have a majority of non-kosher milk, it can't get mixed in so well anymore that you won't recognize it. But the Rav Nezer assumes he meant if you had a small enough portion, 1/6, let's say, of non-kosher milk, that would mix in well, so you wouldn't be able to tell. But you'd have a problem of tamom mamasho. You'd have a problem of it's mixing of that even in the mixture, even though we can't notice it. That many rishonim hold that it is if the original milk is still there, and then it's not a question of tam kikar at all. So that's all by way of saying that he doesn't understand the note of Yehuda is turning to this shach as support for his position because he doesn't think the shach could possibly be holding what the note of Yehuda is claiming has claimed that he's holding. And therefore, the Avnei Nezer assumes that what the Shach really meant was, as the Shach wrote, that it's the problem of min bimino that's the question. Min bimino is, again, when two items are the exact same thing, except one is kosher, one is not. Milk is a good example. If, to the extent that they're largely interchangeable, they're not completely interchangeable, we've already said, but if they're largely interchangeable. If you have, like as I said before, wines where something happened to make one of the wines prohibited, but they're the exact same wine, and the thing that happened is a halakhic thing that happened, right? Another case would be, you know, if in the time when we still ate truma, if a kohen ate truma, if you have, you know, some wheat that's truma, and fine, and some wheat that's truma but got tummy. So to get tummy, all that happens is a tummy person, a person who is not ritually pure, touches it at a certain time, when it's already been moistened and touches that, makes it tummy. When they get mixed together, truma that has become ritually impure is inedible. It's not allowed to be eaten, but they certainly don't taste any different. So that's where issues of min bimino come up. You have the exact same item, yet one falls into the other and they get mixed together. So that's what led the Shach to think. So the Shach felt that since min bimino is batel min hatorah birov, that even if, this is the way the Avnei Nezer is explaining the Shach, even if the non-Jew were going to substitute it, at a Torah level there would be no problem because min bimino. So how can it be min-mino? It's non-kosher milk. So he says, it's true. Even though non-kosher milk tastes a little different and it looks a little different, it's not noticeable if it's in the minority. If it became the majority, then you'd notice it. But in the minority, it's not noticeable. Since it's not noticeable, it's still considered min-mino. It's considered the same type of food. And therefore, the biblical idea that it can be batel biro, that it can be nullified and obscured by the majority of the mixture, comes into play. So therefore, concludes the Avnei Nezer that the Shach is no help to the Note of Yehuda. Then he points out, again, as another proof of the Note of Yehuda, he doesn't think that the common mainstream halachic thought agrees with the Note of Yehuda, that in your idea there's actually halacha. Let's say, and it seems that everybody agrees to it, that if you have an egg, that you found a little piece of blood in it. This, I think, really doesn't happen anymore, but there was certainly a time when it happened regularly. I know I, growing up, and I still do it when I make eggs for myself for some reason, but it's unclear as to where it comes from. I mean, not unclear. It's no longer our situation, but it certainly used to be true. You could find drops of blood in an egg because that was an egg that had been fertilized. That was an egg that had been fertilized, and the chick hadn't developed in any way whatsoever. You just have a drop of blood, which shows that. So the blood makes it usser. Now, it's usser misafek because you don't know what it is, but when it comes to the yolk and the white, it's usser shalobamino at shishim, meaning up until 60, meaning we treat it like its taste is a problem. And the Shach seems to agree, and the Pri Chadash quotes the Shach as saying that. So here it's the egg itself, and the egg itself isn't as serious as the dam as the blood, and the blood is the thing that has malkot baby, but the egg doesn't have malkot because it's just the egg that happened to have a blood spot in it, and yet we treat it as a time issue. So that's another, he thinks, another proof that the Shach A doesn't agree with the Rabbi Yehuda, and that the Rabbi's position doesn't seem to fit the halakhic position, because the egg seems to acquire a status of tam kikar, or a problem of being that its taste is prohibited, and that prohibition would not seem to be at the level that the Rabbi Yehuda required, a level that gets malkot, and yet we treat it that way in halakha. So, again, we're not going to know how the Note of Yehuda would have answered because he's not with us, because that's what happens later on. That's the way halachic discourse goes, right? You write a book, you leave a book behind, you go to the next world to your eternal reward, and then other people come along and they have questions on you. You don't get always a chance to answer that. Another problem with the Note of Yehuda says, the Avnei Nezer, is that he also derived his idea from a Rambam. When the Rambam said that chalav and beitzim and milk and eggs don't have malkot, and so that led them to think, oh, since they don't have malkot, that's why certain halachos don't apply to them. But the Avnei Nezer says, but if you read on in that Rambam, the Rambam says, v'zek ochel chatzishir. and that milk and eggs become, because of the way their prohibitions are set up in the Torah, it becomes, you don't get malkot for them, you don't get lasher for them. He says it's like eating a chatzishir. Chatzishir is a common halachic phrase. It really means literally half the amount, meaning what is the status of, let's say there's a piece of pig in front of me. In halacha, eating is only happens as an act of eating after a kezayit. A kezayit is an olive's worth. So a chatzishir would be less than olive's worth. What's the halachic status of less than olive's worth? There's two possibilities to see that. You could say, until you've eaten a formal halachic eating, it doesn't count, and it's fine. That's one possibility. We don't pass it that way. We assume that chatzi shir is aser min haTorah, is prohibited from the Torah, but of course there's not going to be any punishment for it because you had no shir. You didn't have the requisite amount. When the Rambam is referring to chalav and beitzim, to milk that's not kosher, and to eggs that are not kosher, that don't have a formal prohibition that creates lashes, he refers to it as chatzishir. That's important for the Avnei Nezer, that comparison, because there's a Gemara in Chulin that talks about exactly the question of whether chatzishir is an issue of tam or has an issue of tam or not. So the Gemara in Chulin on Sadiqin Amanav reports a case of a half a zayit of prohibited fat that falls into a pot of meat, and the Amora at hand was thinking that he would decide, he would figure out, are there 30 half zaytim keneged? I mean, he thought he could nullify by 1 in 30. We ordinarily go with 1 in 60 to be sure there's no tam, to be sure there's no taste. He was thinking, it's only a chatzishir, I can do it with 1 in 30, and that's probably good enough. Now, the truth is, it's likely good enough in pure tam situations, but the problem was only that he was doing it with a lower standard as compared to the standard for regular Yisurim. So the other Amora says to him, it was Mar Bar Rav Ashi who thought, his idea was that I'll only have to use 30 half zaytim to nullify it. As long as I can be confident with 30 times the prohibited stuff that fell in, that should be good enough. So his father says to him, don't be so lax with shiurim dirabana. And not only that, chatzishir is asur min haTorah, chatzishir is prohibited min haTorah. Meaning, so Mar Bar Rav Ashi seems to have thought, well, the tam, the taste isn't so important for this lesser form of issue, of isur, of prohibition. But his father Rav Ashi says to him, no, it is, because min haTorah, so that shows that with chatzishir, we apparently say tam kikar min haTorah. We apparently do think that taste is an issue at a Torah level, and therefore it should be true based on the Rambam's language of milk and of eggs. And that's the way that Avnei Nezer thinks you have to understand that sukkah. Yeah. And he points out that when you think about the source for the whole idea of tam kikar was the nazir with mishrat anavim, with the soaked grapes creating taste. It didn't say anything there about achila, about eating, and therefore there's no reason to think that it was a function of the fact that it was a full prohibited item that created a full prohibited eating, that as long as there's enough there that you can drink it and it counts as a drinking. So that's more proof for the Avnei Nezer that this whole idea that tam kikar doesn't apply to certain prohibitions doesn't hold water, because we see that it's applying to chatzishir, which is the parallel case to what the Nodavi was talking about, to the milk and the eggs, because the Rambam calls those being like a chatzishir by virtue of the fact that their prohibition doesn't create malkot. Another example of that is that according to Rabbi Yochanan, who's the one who holds that chatzishir is prohibited in the Torah, he also holds when it comes to small pots and pans, by small we mean really, really small, that they can't contain a kezayit in them. So you might have thought, well, let's say a non-Jew would use them for prohibited stuff, maybe I don't need to kosher them because the prohibited stuff was never a kezayit's worth, it was never an olive's worth. How do I know? Because it doesn't even hold an olive's worth. So I might have thought, I don't even need to do agala. That would be, let's say, an example that would be relevant. Let's say I, for some reason, bought or inherited used measuring spoons from a non-Jew who used them for non-kosher, for hot non-kosher too. So I might have thought, well, the stuff that's an eighth of a teaspoon never had a shear in it. Maybe I don't have to worry about that because it never had a shear, so it doesn't create any problem. But the answer is, Rav Yochanan holds that it needs hagala, it does need kashering. So that would again seem to say that even though it's not a shear, even though it's not a mount, we have to treat it as if its taste is a problem, because that's what hagala is for. Hagala is there to uproot, to get to not uproot, to root out, is I think the phrase that I meant to say, is to get rid of the taste that's left over in those spoons. So it shows you that there is an idea of tam kikar, that you have to worry about the taste added to right to level, even for chatzishir, which leads to the rest of the discussion. More than that, says the Avnei Nezer, I think the Nodavuta's logic actually goes the other way. The Nodavuta's logic was that you need a more serious prohibition for it to also apply to tam. I get that logic. I personally, this, you don't know what you're talking to. I get that logic. The logic would be that time is an extension of an iser, of a prohibition. So the more serious prohibitions are the ones that have these extensions. The Ebenezer says, I see it the other way. Now, as soon as you see that, it reminds me of something to keep in mind always. The idea that important, serious Torah scholars, well-learned, well-versed, can have all the same facts in front of them and see it the opposite way. And in those situations, it becomes a real important halakhic question as to how we handle that and what we think it means about the results that come out. That's a topic that's in my head, not in the Shuvah's head, so I'll leave it right there, but I throw it out there to start thinking about. Anyway, the Avdinez says that if you're going to apply a prohibition of time to a serious prohibition, then for sure he thinks you'd apply it to a less serious prohibition. The reason he thinks that is that the Gemara in Zvachim says that when it comes to Rotev, to the sauce of certain things, of certain sacrifices, that they don't get caught up in Pigul and Notar and Tame. Pigul, Notar and Tame are prohibitions that apply to sacrifice. Pigul is what you think that you're going to eat or use a sacrifice beyond the time when Allah allows. Notar is when you actually leave over a sacrifice beyond the time that you were supposed to have eaten it. And Tame is when it became ritually impure. So the fact that that happens to the sacrifices doesn't affect their rotev, their sauce, even though that sauce clearly contains in it the taste of the original thing. And those are all examples of karet prohibitions. And those karet prohibitions, the Gemara tells us, doesn't apply tam kikar. The rotev doesn't get caught up, which means, seems to mean, the taste is not an issue. Tam kikar doesn't apply to those very serious prohibitions. So, if that's true about a kares, then if we find out that for an isr lav, that for a lav prohibition, it does apply, then all the more so it should apply to a regular prohibition. The other way around, he's saying, if it's not true of a kares, then it means that there's no kal v'chomer here, and then it means that the Rebbe's idea that it only applies to the more serious doesn't apply. So then he says, he thinks it might go the other way, that once we see that the more serious stuff doesn't have a time issue, and the reason there would probably be, when it's such a serious prohibition, you say, it's only the actual item that has that prohibition, but there's no reason why it should go to anything else. It's the actual item that's prohibition. If that's true, then I say that the less serious a prohibition, the more likely it is that it covers more things, because the consequences are lower. That, so says the Avnei Nezer. He goes with one final proof of that idea, that he thinks that in the lowest level things, even just regular essays, he wants to show you that we have an idea of tam ki ikar, because the halacha is, let's say somebody makes a matzah from a mixture, a flour that's a mixture of wheat flour and rice flour. So the Mishnah says in Challah that if it has the taste of matzah to it, it qualifies of meaning of wheat matzah to it, then it qualifies for all the wheat purposes as wheat matzah. So there he thinks it's actually, he says it's actually a whole different idea. He thinks that the reason why you can or can't be yotah, the reason we can or cannot use a certain grain for fulfillment of the mitzvah of matzah is based on whether or not it can become chametz. So if there's enough wheat in a mixture that it would become chametz and we would notice the chametz aspect of it, that means the wheat is a live part of the mixture and therefore it can qualify for a chametz prohibition. Therefore it can qualify for a fulfilling the mitzvah of matzah as well. But it's not a time issue. It's not a taste issue. It is not what's going on there. So it's not he thinks that there it's not an application of the question of tam kikar or not. It's not that since it tastes like wheat. It's that since it tastes like wheat, that makes us think that it can become chametz if it were left to become chametz, and therefore it can be used as matzah. There's a bit more here, but I'm running out of my time anyway, so I'll stop here because these are the essential issues that I wanted to cover that I thought were worth our while to review. They come up in basic context, they come up in lots of context. The questions of how kashrus works in terms of when items that are prohibited get mixed in places, when do we have to worry about those mixtures, when do we not have to worry about those mixtures, and how do they affect our lives in these various ways. And all of those were issues that came up in this response of the day for the 13th of Nisan from the Avnei Nezer. A chance to get to hear from the Avnei Nezer, who is disputing the Nota Behuda about the question of taste in general, and in particular the taste of chametz after the 14th of midday on the 14th of Nisan, when it's an ordinary prohibition, is that taste prohibited in a Torah or not? The response of the day, with thanks to the OU, to Rabbi Jacob Brown, to David Hochhauser. Have a great day, and tomorrow we'll have to say have a great Pesach. We'll already start thinking about it tonight. Have a great B'dikas chametz, I guess, which would be for tonight, and have a great day. Bye.